feet and daylight unto my path. And a light unto, a light unto my path, my path.
Welcome to Searchlight, a survey through Scripture with Pastor John Corson. It is our desire to bring you a systematic study of the entire Bible, chapter by chapter, book by book. In our last Searchlight program, we saw the Lord give Gideon and the nation of Israel a tremendous victory over the Midianites. It is a victory over seemingly insurmountable odds. But nothing is too hard for God. As we continue the story today, Gideon is involved in some mop-up operations in this battle. On the way, he asks a couple of Israelite towns for some food for his men. Both places refuse because they still fear the enemy. Gideon tells them that once the battle with the Midianites is complete, he will come back and deal with them. That is, he will discipline them. As we join John today for our conclusion to the study in Judges chapter 8, he is explaining why this discipline is necessary. Here now is Pastor John.
Obtaining the victory is one thing. Seeing a kid get saved is grand and glorious. But maintaining that through loving discipline when necessary, that's the key to really seeing long-term stability and long-term success in a family, in a church, in a job site, in whatever it might be. Obtaining victory in battle is exciting. The real trick is maintaining it in the days that come or the days that follow. Gideon seems to understand this and knows that he cannot let that go undisciplined. And he says, you guys will get the point when I drag you to the cactus. And you guys are going to see what it means to not be doing what you ought to be doing when your tower, your place of pride is pulled down when I come back again. Well, now verse 10, Zeba and Zalmunna, these are the kings of the Midianites, were in Karkor. And their host was about 15,000 men, all that were left from that army. For there fell 120,000 men that drew the sword. So 120,000 are dead, 15,000 remain, as we said previously. And Gideon went up by the way of them that dwelt in tents on the east of Nobah and Jogbeha, and smote the host. The 15,000 were smitten, and the host was secure. And when Zeba and Zalmunna fled, their armies now lost, their armies wiped out, then Gideon pursues after them and took the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and discomfited the host, that is, the host being wiped out. And now he takes these two kings. And Gideon, verse 13, the son of Joash, returned from battle before the sun was up. And he caught a young man of the men of Succoth, or Succoth, and inquired of him. And this young man from that town that didn't help Gideon when Gideon was needing help or supplies or bread, he described this young guy, the leaders of Succoth. And the elders, there was 70, or 77 men. So he came, verse 15, to the men of Succoth and said, behold, here's Zeba and Zalmunna. You said, are those kings in your hand? Well, here they are, guys. You wouldn't give me bread because I didn't have them in my hand? Well, here they are. We've captured them. You did upbraid me, saying, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand that we should give you bread? So he then took the elders, verse 16, of the city, and the thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. He dragged them through the cactus. He stripped them, as would be done in that day, of all their clothing, and literally dragged them through this thorn patch until they would be ripped apart and bleeding. Then they got the point, and he taught them a lesson. And then he, verse 17, went back to Penuel, and he beat down the tower and slew the men of the city. So he goes to the tower and pulls down that tower, and it's referred to later in Scripture, but be that as it may, the men of the city were killed that day. Then, verse 18, he says to these two kings, Ziba and Zalmunna, "What manner of men were they whom you slew at Tabor?" This is where Gideon lived. This was the place where Gideon was hanging out in the wine press in this region. Now watch the question here. Who were the guys that you killed, Zalmunna? Who were the guys that you killed, Ziba, in that neighborhood of Tabor? Who were they? And these guys, Ziba and Zalmunna, said, "Well, as you are, so were they. They looked just like you. The guys that we killed at Tabor, Gideon, they looked just like you look." And then with a bit of flattery, they say, "Each one resembled the children of a king." Oh, anyway, you know, they look just like you, like king's kids, you know, like movie stars. Well, why'd they say that? Well, they're captured, you know. The guys we killed at Tabor, they look just like you. They're good-looking guys, you know. People magazine most eligible bachelors or whatever it might be. They're good-looking guys, you see. Then Gideon dropped the bomb. "Those were my brothers, the sons of my mother. That's why they looked like me. I'm from that area. And those men that you killed, they were my brothers. As the Lord liveth, if you have saved them alive, I wouldn't slay you. If you showed my brothers mercy, I wouldn't slay you." And he then said to Jether, verse 20, Gideon's oldest son, "Up and slay them." But the youth drew not his sword, for he feared because he was a youth. "Me? Kill those two kings? Kill them, Jether. I would spare them if they would have spared my brothers, but they were merciless to our family. Now, Jether, you kill those men." But Jether wouldn't do it. Then Ziba and Zalmunna said to Gideon, "Rise thou, you Gideon, rise up and fall upon us. For as the man is, so is his strength." The idea here is, Gideon, you kill us, if you can. Because as the man is, so is his strength or his offspring. Your son's a chicken, and you are too. Your son doesn't have the guts to kill us, and you won't either. Well, that wasn't the best thing to say. So Gideon arose that day, and he slew Ziba and Zalmunna, and took away their ornaments. Look at your margin if you have a margin reference. They're literally crescents or moon crescents. And for you that follow through on the understanding of Islam and so forth and so on, it's an ancient religion. And this idea of Allah, the moon god, was also linked with the idea of Baal worship and the men of Midian. And this idea of the ornaments like crescents, Gideon took them that were on their camels' necks. Then, verse 22, the men of Israel said to Gideon at this time, "Rule thou over us, both you and your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." Gideon, be our king, and your son, and his son after you, a dynasty. We want you to be our king and establish a dynasty and rule over our land. Gideon, what a victory came our way. The Midianites are wiped out. Their kings are dead. Our country is free. Ah, Gideon, be our king. And Gideon, and I love this, he said, "I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you, but the Lord shall rule over you." Man, I like that. "Sorry, I'm not going to rule over you, nor my son, nor my son's son," is the idea. There's not going to be a dynasty. I'm not going to establish a monarchy. God is your king. God is your king. See, the Apostle Paul put it this way: we do not seek to have dominion over you, but are helpers of your joy. And there are those that want to establish themselves as kings spiritually. That is, there are those that say, "I'm your covering, and you need to be in submission to me. And before you take that job or date that girl or move to that house, you've got to check in with me because I'm the leader, I'm the apostle, or I'm the prophet, or I'm the pastor, or I'm the elder, or I'm whatever. And I'm in spiritual leadership, and I'm going to rule, you see. Ought not to be. Paul said, no, we will not have dominion over you. That's not what we do. We just want to help out your joy. We want to help you get close to the Lord and learn about the Lord and be amazed at the Lord. We're not here to have you linked to us. And that's certainly true, as far as I'm concerned, here at Applegate. See, I have no desire, we have no desire to rule over people or to sign you up and lock you into a membership kind of structure where the implication might be submission and linkage in that kind of way. We're all to be submitted one to another. But as servants, we're to be not seeking to have dominion over people, but just helpers of joy. You know, somebody was talking to my wife a few weeks ago and said, you know, we went to Applegate for a number of years and we left and went to another fellowship because the church is just so big and we didn't get to know you guys, you know, you or John, and we just didn't feel the friendship that we thought we were craving for. So we went to another fellowship and got real involved there and stuff, and now we're back. And my wife said, well, why is that? And she said, because you know what? Even though you might not know our names, fact is, it's not about you. Fact is, you guys there, through Kay Apple and the various studies and opportunities, are teaching us about Jesus. It's not about building some kind of a structure of friendship circles or what have you, or having dinner with the pastor once a month. It's about Jesus. And when I heard that, I go, that is exactly right. If people are coming to Applegate so that they can be known or what have you, it's not going to happen necessarily, because we don't seek to do that. It's not about, you know, well, what ladder can I climb and how known can I be and can I develop this kind of relationship with those guys or whatever it might be. Problem is, those kinds of structures, by the way, inevitably fail. Because the truth is, in ministry, in church work, in anything to do with spiritual life, how you catch people is how you'll keep them. And if you catch them because you have, we're the friendliest fellowship in town, or, you know, we're the friendliest church around, or whatever it might be, you got to keep them that way. And it's fine if there's 100 people, or 300 people, or 500 people. But when you get to be 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000 or whatever it might be, the problem is you caught them based upon that, and now you got to keep them in that same way, and it's going to drive you insane as a leader, as a pastor, a teacher, a brother, a worker, whatever it might be. Can't be done. But if you catch people, so to speak, because you're pointing them to Jesus and they're falling in love with Jesus, then whether there's 10 people or 110,000 people, it makes no difference, because the issue isn't about pastors or people. It's about Jesus, see? And whether there's a small study or a great big coliseum filled with folks, doesn't matter a whit. If the purpose is we want you to look to Jesus, fall in love with Jesus, really be caught up in Jesus. It's not ministry structures, church programs, or little groups. It's about Jesus, see? It's about Jesus, it's about Jesus. And I feel that so passionately. And frankly, that's why it's a joy serving this church, because it's not built on some structure. It's built upon a person, and that person is Jesus Christ. Gideon here understands that fact intuitively. It's not about me, Gideon said. It's not about that. It's about you following the Lord and letting the Lord rule over you. So he refused to take this honor and be this king over the nation. He said, no, God's going to rule over you. Now, Gideon, though, does, he's a man of God, but he is a man, and the chapter ends with a mistake that is made, sad to say. Gideon said to them, now I would desire a request from you, though, that you would give me every man the earrings of his prey. These Midianites had earrings. They had golden earrings in their ears because they were Ishmaelites. And they said, oh, we'll willingly give them to you. So they spread out a garment and did cast therein every man the earrings of the guys that they killed in battle. And the weight of the earrings was 1,700 shekels of gold, or approximately 70 pounds of gold. That's a lot of earrings. 70 pounds of gold. Hey, you're talking about some real wealth here that was accumulated. And he says, I want those, just give me the earrings from the guys that fell in battle. Sure, Gideon, be happy to. And it came to about 70 pounds of gold, besides the ornaments and the colors and the purple and the raiments that was there taken that day, and the chains that were about the camel's necks too. Well, Gideon takes this gold, and he made, verse 27, an ephod. Now, an ephod was that vest-like coat, small waistcoat-like thing that was worn by the high priest. And the ephod was a priestly garment. And he takes the gold, and he makes a golden ephod. Perhaps the idea was that the folks might realize, hey, it's not about a king politically. It's about a priest spiritually. Be spiritual. Don't be political. You want a king? I'm going to make this golden ephod to remind you that it's a spiritual matter, that we're a spiritual people. That may have been his intention. Also, with the ephod was connected the breastplate, the Urim and the Thummim. You're going, what? The Urim and the Thummim was used to determine God's will. Remember, if you didn't know what to do, the Urim and the Thummim means lights and perfection. It was connected to the breastplate, a part of the breastplate, which was part of the ephod. All that's to say simply this. Gideon's mind, heart could have very well been, I'm going to make this golden ephod to remind you it's not about kings politically, it's about life spiritually. And God's will, he's going to rule over you. And this golden ephod will remind you of that fact. But what happened was he made the ephod. He put it in his city, verse 27, Ophrah. And all Israel went there a whoring after it. And the thing became a snare unto Gideon and to his house. They began to worship the golden ephod. They went a whoring after it. I mean, he builds this golden ephod and they begin to worship it. Gideon ought to have known better. The tendency and propensity of people to want to exalt a person. They already did that. We want you to be a king. Or to exalt a thing. Oh, this ephod, let's go worship it, you see. Careful that we don't look at places or things as being special. Oh, the amphitheater, see. It's just a pit covered with grass, see. Oh, the mountaintop. It's a shale mountain. We just took the top off to put some cabins on. Oh, but in the sanctuary. These are just things, see. But if not careful, people can begin to marvel at things or exalt people. Always a danger. Always. You know, as I've studied church revival over many years, I've learned something. I've noticed something. That when there's a revival, it starts with a man, like you, like me, who would say, Lord, just use us, use me to the greatest degree. And God gives that man a ministry. You have a man that has a ministry that God entrusts to him. And from that ministry, there can be a movement. Things can begin to happen. And there can be a movement. And there can be a lot of impact and effect. Man, ministry, movement. And then that's fine. But then can so often come a monument. A monument to the man. And it could be that Gideon, see, he put it in his city. And although it was an ephod, it was made of gold. By the way, subtly, Gideon might have been thinking, the people will remember who got the gold. Hey, under me, see. If Gideon was really sincere, completely, totally sincere about an ephod to just remind people, which was only to be worn by the high priest anyway, it wasn't to be in Ophrah. It was to be with the tabernacle, with the high priest. But he would have made it out of material that was described earlier in the book of Exodus. A golden one, isn't that a little bit gaudy? I don't mean godly, but gaudy. I mean, is that really what you want to say, Gideon? See? And it could be that in this, on one hand, in humility and wisdom, I won't rule over you. But on the other hand, but I'll make this golden ephod and it'll be a reminder of the great victory that came under my leadership, you see. It's subtle. It's insidious. And the people, oh, wow. Look at this ephod. Man, cool, Gideon. It's in your hometown where you're from. That reminds us you're pretty cool. See? And they worship this thing. And it was a snare. Thus, verse 28, Midian was subdued before Israel so that they lifted up their heads no more. The Midianites, hey man, they weren't going around proud anymore. The country was quiet 40 years in the days of Gideon. But Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and dwelt in his own house, and he had 70 sons. So Gideon now retires, if you would, from leading the army. There's peace in the land for years that number 40. He goes back home again, and he has 70 sons, for he had many wives. And his concubine that was in Shechem, she bore him a son whose name he called Abimelech. Now stay with me here. We're almost done, but stay with me here. Because here's this great guy, Gideon, and we can learn some real important lessons. In the time of battle and difficulty, he excelled and did well. The real danger, though, is when there's peace and prosperity. Right now, in many countries around the world, you know, in Thailand, in the Balkan countries, in Afghanistan, in a number of places where the war has stopped, yet it's a real dangerous place because there's millions of landmines that you've been reading about that are still in place. And the countries are too poor to track those landmines down and to pull them out. The point is that even though the war is over, it's more dangerous in some ways than ever. And so too in spiritual life, the battle can be won, the victory can be secure, your kids can be launched and raised, and you can say, now it's time for me to kick back. It's time for me to rest a bit. It's time, oh, Gideon, watch out. Watch out, my brother. When you begin to say, you know, it's time for me to just kind of rest a bit. Because what he did was, I'm not going to be a king, but he pulled away. Kings were not to collect gold. Kings were not to multiply wives. Remember? Three things kings were forbidden to do. You're not to amass gold, you're not to multiply wives, and you're not to gather horses. It doesn't say anything about horses with Gideon, but it does say he collected gold. He didn't become a king, but he began to live like one, a very wealthy man. And he had lots of wives and concubines. You know, they say about sailors, he has a girl in every port. Well, Gideon evidently had a gal in every town. And he had 70 sons. And it's going to become a problem for him. And one of his concubines, one of his gals that he had, bore him a son. And we're going to talk about his story next week. But his name was Abimelech, which means literally, my father is a king. See? My father is a king. That's what this son was named. And Abimelech is a double loser. We'll study him next week.
We will air this study of Abimelech very soon here on Searchlight. And as Pastor John said, Abimelech is a loser. And in his story, we will see how Israel can go from the blessing of victory under Gideon to the pit under Abimelech. It's not a fun story, but one that is instructive for us.
This teaching is also available on the Searchlight website at johncorson.com. You will also find on the website Pastor John's books and other Bible study resources. Again, the address of the website is johncorson.com. That's johncorson.com.
We would like to remind you that on the Searchlight website, you can find Pastor John's teachings through the entire Bible. You can listen to the audio or watch the video of any of these teachings from the website at any time for no charge. The Searchlight website address is johncorson.com.
Searchlight is a listener-supported ministry. We appreciate your prayers and support. May the Lord richly bless you.